come to order. Representative Carlson, do you want to move the minutes of February
22nd? Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the minutes of February 22nd.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Minutes are adopted. Mr. Marks and Mr. Nauman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your folders, you should have a group of four graphs and a couple legal size pages with lots of numbers on. what we've been asked to talk about this morning is to look at spending over time. These charts start in fiscal year 1998, run through the actual numbers for fiscal 2012, and then the projections for fiscal years 13, 14, and 15. The 13, 14, 15 numbers are actually from the November forecast yet. We don't have consolidated fund statement numbers for the February forecast yet. We do have general fund, but this was also put together, or most of this was put together before the forecast came out. These numbers do come from Minnesota Management and Budget's consolidated fund statement, which is a tracking basically of general fund plus all the other operating funds, so the numbers are a lot bigger here than when we're talking about general fund only. Also, just to make a distinction, these are spending numbers. Week and a half ago, the presentation MMB did on price of government was revenue numbers, and that was state and local government revenue. This is just state government spending. In general, spending and revenue are going to track each other pretty similarly. The difference usually would be if you're building up reserves or spending down reserves allows some flexibility there. So we're going to start off with the one legal size sheet that says on – it's the bigger print legal size sheet that you have, and it says Minnesota State Budget Expenditures, all operating funds on across the top of it, and use that and the graphs. And the first graph, and I believe it's the first one in the order in your folder, just says expenditures, all funds on it, is the title across the top, and it's the one that's on the overhead here. And on the legal size sheet, you can see that sheet is broken into four, if you go up and down the sheet, four categories of numbers here. The top category on there, which says actual dollars on the legal size sheet, and then there are a couple lines there, general fund spending, all other spending, total spending, and then dollar change and percent change. The general fund spending is the general fund spending number from the consolidated fund statement, and I would just point out that there is a difference between this number and the general fund number that we're typically used to. And that's and this number is usually smaller. It's because things that are what we think of as general fund expenditures, and the best example is the debt service spending. We have a category in the general fund for debt service or paying off the principal and interest payments on general obligation bonds. We treat that as general fund spending when we're dealing with the general fund. That's actually a transfer to the debt service fund, and then the spending is out of the debt service fund. That's when we get to the consolidated fund statement. So in this comparison, debt service spending, for example, is in all other fund spending because it's in the debt service fund rather than the general fund. So the numbers aren't the only thing you need to think about is this general fund number is going to be different than if you were looking at just a general fund only spending statement. But it's because of those transfer kinds of issues. There are other transfers out of the general fund as well. For example, veterans' home spending is a general fund expenditure. It's transferred to a special revenue fund account, spent from that account. This tracks where the money's spent from. So there are some differences. But so the general fund spending in the first line across here is showing general fund spending from fiscal 98 through fiscal 15. The 13, 14, and 15 numbers are the projections from the November forecast. Obviously, 13 is going to be fairly accurate because it's based on appropriations that are actually occurring. 14 and 15 are based on the current law projections that have gone into the forecast. Those numbers will change after the 2013 session and actual appropriations are made for those years. Then the same is true for all other fund spending. And then the two are added together in the total spending line. And then you can see the dollar change from year to year and the percentage change from year to year. And then if you go to the graph that says expenditures all funds, the first one in your folder, you can see that that graph tracks that spending. The lower part of each bar, the light blue color, is the general fund spending. The upper part of the bar is all the other funds, the kind of maroon or purplish color there. And you can see that as the numbers show, there have been years when all fund spending has decreased slightly in the cases when it has, but in fiscal 2004, fiscal 2012, fiscal 2014, each has shows a decrease from the previous year. If you look at the light blue versus the purple, you can see there are years when general fund spending has gone down and all fund spending may have made up for it, so that the total hasn't changed greatly. Remember again that this is all funds spending, so things like implementing shifts in education aid payments or paying back shifts in education aid payments are going to affect how this bounces up and down.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and members, I will take the next one. If I can make this flip over to the next slide. Is it the click here? Help me here. In any case, while she's doing that, we've taken essentially the same these data and sliced and diced them a couple of different ways because there's a variety of different ways that you can look at the data. So the first set of data was actual dollars. You would see them in the consolidated fund statement over time, but they don't adjust for inflation. So the second set of data makes a CPI adjustment, and we've turned this into, if you again, as Mr. Marks did, I'm going to ask you to crosswalk between the legal document and the slide that's now on the overhead, and this is expenditures all fund and just adjusted for inflation. The inflationary adjustment that we're using in this case is the consumer price index. We've turned them into 2013 dollars, pocketbook. Issue being that you'd know what 2013 means, so we thought that that was the most meaningful comparison. We're looking at the second band of data now, and the first thing that you'll note is that we have a consumer price index change over time. That's that percentage along the top, and then I would like you to take a look to begin with at the 2013 numbers. You'll notice that the 2013 numbers have a 100% index, and that the numbers that fall beneath them are exactly the same as the numbers above. And that's what it means to turn it into a 2013 number. So the numbers that we are projecting for 14 and 15 are depressed slightly down into 2013 numbers, and the numbers from 98 up until 2012 are grown to reflect the percentage change. So this is how you make an index and adjust the dollars into today's money. And that, when you look at the chart, you'll notice if you compare it back to the previous chart that we were just looking at, it's flatter. And that's exactly what you would expect over time. And it will tend to accentuate some of the, or reveal a little bit more some of the changes. So you see the fiscal 2003 dollars in inflation adjustment still show that bump, and that would be largely the takeover of the gen ed levy, which became effective in that year. You see the relationship between the all funds and the general fund in fiscal 10 would affect the stimulus, the infusion of the fiscal stimulus in that year. And so I think that this tends to flatten things out a little bit more and show you if you make an inflationary adjustment, what happens in that. Are there questions about that chart? Yeah.
Okay. So can we just go back just for a sec and just defining what's in the general fund versus these other funds? Is it all sources of revenues going through those, so state general fund taxes as well as federal transfers that go in? So it includes federal and state.
Mr. Chair, it's spending as opposed to revenue.
Right.
And it's the general, it will be whatever money is spent out of the general fund. For the most part, federal funds will not be in the general fund. They are in the federal fund category, which is in the all other funds.
That's
area.
What I'm asking, right.
So almost all federal funds are in here. There are some, those federal funds that pass through the state treasury. A couple of examples of those that don't, Head Start money, for example, goes directly from the federal government to the agencies that run those programs. That's not in here because it never goes through the state treasury. The University of Minnesota gets quite a bit of federal money that comes directly from the federal government to the university. So that's not in here because it doesn't go through the state treasury. But medical assistance, Medicaid, all of those kind of funds that go through the state treasury are in here. We do have a chart that we're going to look at last that does list the dollar amounts per fund so that you can see what the amounts, kind of what size each fund is. It's that last the other legal sheet that's in here that lists all of those.
So if I could just, so for instance, for Medicaid, there's a state portion that's in the general fund.
Correct.
And where's the federal match part of that then? Where does that show up?
The federal match on that would show up in the federal funds category because it's spent as a federal fund.
We'll wait till we get to this chart. Okay, that's fine.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Marks, and Mr. Nauman, do these charts then take into account the cuts from sequestration, or are there or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, no, they do not.
And these are the numbers from the November forecast.
November, okay.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marks, you got to help me. I'm a little confused here. When I'm looking at the expenditures all funds chart, and if we go into the area of, say, fiscal year 10, 11, 12, in that area, our current budget is, from general funds, I thought was around $35 billion, 34 something. And then expenditures from all funds, including, you know, federal funds, local funds, et cetera, we were up to like $62 billion. What am I missing here? When I look at this chart, it looks like general fund spending in the 10, 11, 12 area is under $15 billion, and when we go to all funds, we're under $30 billion. What am I missing?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, the only thing you're missing is you're using biennial numbers. These are annual numbers. So these are about half the level annual. You're thinking of because they're a single year as opposed to 2 years or the 2 years of the biennial.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I think we'll move to the next chart.
Okay.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and members, again, continuing with another way to adjust the data, now we're in the third band on the legal size document that we've been sort of cross-referencing to. And I think this may get to some of the questions that you dealt with on the price of government the last time when you talk about spending per capita. So, again, the same data, all we've done here is divided out by the population count of the fiscal year in question. So, again, we're looking at 98 data through 2015, and here we're taking whole data, so previous data was represented in thousands. We're taking the actual dollars, dividing by the actual population, and you can see the breakout again. You'll see, again, in 2013 that there's a little bit of a bump. Again, that's probably the general education takeover. In fiscal 10, we're going to highlight these years for you repeatedly. That 2013, the relationship between the all funds and the general fund changes a little bit. That's probably the ARRA money. And then you see the projections for fiscal 13. We think that fiscal 13 is probably a little bit higher as a result of the buy-off that we've been doing on the buying back of the education shifts. So those tend to affect the spending, as Mr. Marks noted on the front end.
And then, Mr. Chair, members, the final chart, which says expenditures, all funds per capita adjusted for inflation. This is essentially adding the two factors together. It's taking spending, dividing by population, as Mr. Nauman just explained, and then adjusting for inflation, as he explained in the earlier one. So it's essentially the effects of both charts 2 and 3 added together into number 4. So it's all funds adjusted for population and adjusted for inflation. On the legal size chart, you can see the actual numbers there, and on the graph itself, you can see it flattens things a little bit more because it's adjusting for two factors that are growing, inflation and population. And then, again, you can see the mix between general fund and all the other funds for those adjusted numbers.
Okay, so again, in 2003 then, which seems to be the most fundamental shift, that was when the state took over the general ed levy and property taxes presumably were reduced as a result.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. The 2001 session was the session that made that occur, but it didn't become effective until 2003. So you saw the large jump in, and again, as Mr. Marks pointed out, these are dollars that are expended through the state treasury. Certainly the state aid takeover of the levy became part of the expenditures through the state treasury at that point. So you see that increase. And then, of course, the budget began to, the economy began to slow at that point. So additional changes were made in subsequent sessions that begin to tail some of that increase off after that.
Do you know how much, what was the dollar size of that takeover?
Mr. Chair and members, there's a variety of ways to count this.
Okay.
It kind of depends on what you count first. I was doing the education counts at the time, and the rule of thumb that I'm using, but again, you can count this differently, is about $880 million once you offset for the credits. The gross number was about $1.3 billion. That was the size of the levy at the time. But, of course, there was a collection of credits that offset that. So we net it down to around the neighborhood of $880 million.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Sendrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just a curiosity. Perhaps you've said this as I was trying to catch up. But looking at 11 and 12, where the general fund, you know, kind of stays about the same for each year, but the all other funds, a little bit of a difference there. Are you able to, do you know what that difference might be relative to what was not funded in 12 versus 11 on the all other funds?
Mr. Chair and members, this might be a good point for us to move on to that other legal sheet because it's going to unpack some of the all other funds. So
that's
this
fine.
Is that larger one with some of the smaller detail.
I'll defer, Mr. Chair.
And one of the issues that we will certainly highlight for you, there's probably going to be others that quick eyes will notice, is the total transfers line. Members will note that we are moving from the old budget accounting system into a new one, and we're still working through the reconciliation of the total transfers on this line. This is about three quarters of the way down, and you'll notice that we were tracking along at some negative adjustments on transfers, but then we moved to the new accounting system in FY12, and you'll notice there's about $1 billion of movement on the total transfers, and we think there might be some internal accounting in terms of how agencies pay themselves. So I note we go from a negative 447 in fiscal 11 to a positive 596 in fiscal 12. That's a bit of an anomaly that we're not yet ready to offer an explanation for, but we'll scrub those data a little bit further. Maybe Mr. Marks has some thoughts he'd like to add to that point. I think that might account for some of what you're seeing.
I was Mr. Chair and members, following up on Senator Senjum's question, as far as looking at 9, 10, and 11, one thing that's making up for general fund spending in there would be the federal funds and the stimulus funds. And federal funds are in that top grouping. They're about two-thirds of the way down in the top grouping where it says federal funds on there, and I apologize here. I realize the numbers are small here, or the print is small, but if you look at that federal funds line and you follow over in fiscal year 2008, it was $6 billion. In fiscal year 2009, it became $7.1 billion. In fiscal 2010, it became $8.9 billion. Stayed fairly level at $8.87 billion in 2011. Drops to $7.9 billion in 2012. And then is projected at 8.4 in 13 and around 9 and 9.9 in 14 and 15. But you can you can see that that when we were cutting general fund spending in fiscal year 10, especially 10 and 11, this the federal funds made up for a portion of that, as we understood at the time when the stimulus funds were coming in and replacing some general fund spending. That's one obvious one that would lead to the all fund spending staying higher while general fund was dropping.
Thank you.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, about number 10 down. I'm wondering what's going on there between FY12 and FY13. It looks like it more than doubles, but the other accounts in that amendment, one other one doubles, but the other two don't. So what's going on there?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, what's occurring here? And let me mention one other thing on the Outdoor Heritage Funds, too. As you see, they start in fiscal 10 after the amendment was constitutional amendment was passed. Fiscal 14 and 15 are zeros because these are written as one-time appropriations. Those will get filled in after the bill passes this session. But what's going on in the Outdoor Heritage one, the appropriations are made for a biennium for 2 years, and because the bill passes in May or gets signed into law May or June of a year, a lot of the spending doesn't occur in the first fiscal year. A lot of the spending gets pushed back to the second fiscal year. So probably the better way to think about these is thinking about them as biennial appropriations. There may be written as an appropriation where $5 million available the first year and $5 million available the second year, but because of the timing of things, that $5 million in the first year often doesn't, or all of it doesn't get spent the first year, but it gets carried into the second year.
So, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Marks, that's not true with the Parks and Trails Fund, because that doesn't look like it had the same impact.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, they apparently handle those projects better. This is reporting when the spending occurs, so they handle that better over the two-year period. I don't know that much about how spending occurs in those accounts. We could explore that more. But
Mr. Marks, they'll handle it better. The Outdoor Heritage Fund has so much money, they can't get it out the door.
Mm-hmm. The Clean Water Fund is the same.
So there is, there could be unexpended amounts that aren't reflected here that we've already appropriated. Would that be,
Mr. Chair? It reflects the spending or when the spending is projected to occur. Fiscal 10, 11, and 12 are actual numbers. Fiscal 13 is the projected numbers. Fiscal 13 could include appropriations that don't get spent in fiscal 13 and will cancel back to the fund. Fiscal 10, 11, and 12 should not reflect anything that hasn't been spent yet.
Okay. So 13 could include stuff that was in 12 but hasn't been spent yet.
And Mr. Yes. Chair, that's correct. And yes. And the committee, the legacy committees may be considering, they may get requests to allow things to carry forward into fiscal 14. They may consider those, or there may be cancellations, which they would consider as part of the balance that's available to appropriate again.
Thank you. Mr. Marks or Mr. Nauman, how do you account for the health impact fee dollars? The health impact fund is zero. And is that just a transfer, or what's going on there?
You've hit the nail on the head. We've talked a fair bit about the health impact fee in the Senate this year. As you know, sorry, that was for Senator Laurie. the point is that the dollars are collected and deposited in the fee, but then there is as you know, they then are transferred into the general fund to defease costs associated with public health programs. So while the dollars are not really, it's more of a transfer than it is an actual expenditure out of that fund.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Mr. Nauman, so are they accounted for down here in the total transfers somewhere then, or where?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, they should be accounted for in the general fund because the spending is actually occurring out of the general fund.
Right.
The revenue comes into the health impact fund. There's a certification process. It's then transferred to the general fund. So they should show up in the general fund spending in this one.
Right.
That would be a reverse example of what I mentioned before, where general fund dollars get transferred to the debt service fund and spent there. In this case, health impact fund dollars get transferred to the general fund and spent out of the general fund.
And then before we get off this sheet, Mr. Nauman or Mr. Marks, down another, 10 lines or so is the health care access fund. it stumped me again for a little while. This was the November, based off the November forecast, and so the Minnesota Care waiver expires on December 31st, 13, but the Minnesota Care is still on the books, and so the costs explode in the November forecast, but it's not really what's expected to occur. Is that correct? That's my recollection, and I'd like
Chair and Senator Laurie, I haven't looked at this one carefully, but I think you're right, and I suspect the February forecast numbers might be considerably different for the Health Care Access Fund.
But they'd still show up somewhere.
The spending would show somewhere.
Any other questions on this? And if members want to spend some time looking it over, we can come back to this at the next meeting as well. But if you have questions, specific questions, then we can get Mr. Marks and Mr. Nauman. Yes, so Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, these are good for kind of like just a very general guide. But I mean, if you look at the fiscal 10 and fiscal 12 numbers in both years, there were substantial shifts that warp or distort these year-over-year changes. So is there, I mean, that's a big one that we're all aware of. There's all kinds of other exceptions and some that we've already identified. Is there a way to get a cleaner number than this? I mean, it's good for general trend lines, but you can pick any one year and unique characteristics, whether it be the stimulus money, the shift, and it kind of makes it for every year there's an exception.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, you're 100% right. I mean, the shifts do tend to offer what we would consider a bit of a distortion in the data. But, as Mr. Marks points out at the beginning, these are the dollars that are actually transited through the state treasury at the time. And it represents a policy choice that the legislature and the executive made at that point. It's a different question to ask, how would we offset against the shifts? How would we offset against any potential transfers out of the reserve to offset so you don't have to make a spending choice. You're adding revenue in out of the reserve. Though that is a different question. We could endeavor to deal with it. It's not a simple matter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, I think Mr. Nauman mentioned reserves. I think the two biggest distorting factors would be the education payment shifts and whether we're spending reserves or using spending reserves or building up reserves. Both of those could lead to distortions there. The issue of this reflects the amount that's being spent in a given year. It's not necessarily the amount that school districts, for example, are counting as state aid in a given year because they're counting a different number. So, and there's no right way to do it. You can make the argument that even with education paid shift or education aid payments, if we were at 90-10, which we consider no shift, school districts are accounting 100% of in a given year, so should we be representing 100%? You get a whole number of questions like that. I think the value in this is it shows the resources the state spent in a given year, or the money the state spent, so obviously there had to be resources there to do it. When the spending's down and a shift is implemented, for example, or if the reserves are being spent, there was less available. When their shifts are being paid back, there was more available. So from that perspective, it's accurate as far as what the state has and is able to spend. There are lots of other perspectives or ways to look at it as well.
But with the school shift, for instance, I mean, that's a one-time movement of money. I mean, that over time, that would move back and forth. And I mean, so the trend line would kind of build some of that into it anyway. And even the budget reserves, as they go up and down, I mean, if you look at it over time, that's going to kind of wash itself out.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The trend line is consistent. If we look at one year, if we look at fiscal 12, for example, and say spending dropped in fiscal 12 most likely because we were not only cutting spending, but we were shifting more. If there hadn't been a change in the shift, it probably wouldn't be a drop in that particular year. So So it affects the individual years. We can soften some of that if we looked at biennial numbers. That has some effect by doing that kind of softening, but it's what it is, and for what it is, it's an accurate portrayal, but it's, yeah, there are any number of ways to interpret it.
So, Representative Holford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the consolidated fund statement that by law we're due by the end of the year that we still haven't seen, so we're getting into our third month of being late. Do we know, have you heard from MMB? Are they, I mean, you're not looking at count, you're not looking at final numbers. My understanding is that the workload of the legislative auditor has been put off kilter as well, because they generally expect those accounts to be done at the end of the year. They weren't, so as far as them even being able to audit those statements, do you have any update on that issue for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, you're speaking of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or the CAFR, not the Consolidated Fund Statements. The November one was a bit late, but we have that, and we should be getting a February one soon. As far as the CAFR, we've had some recent discussions with MMB. Our understanding now is they're targeting the end of this month for release of it. It is not out yet, or it is not completed yet. And it was supposed to be done by December 31st for fiscal year 2012.
So Representative Lincheski, and then we're going to have to move on to the next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman or Mr. Marks. You know, I'm intrigued by the second group that has the adjusted inflation category. And I think you explained how you started by, you know, if you look under 1998, it's 143.04%, and you get to 100% in fiscal year 13. And that's based on CPI. Are you aware, do most states use CPI, or do they use PPI, or do they use that other index that kind of capture state and local spending better? I can't remember what it's called. I know there's a number of ways that states can factor in inflation. And do you have thoughts on what decision makers learn from those different indexes? Is there a reason that CPI is best? Or
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nauman.
Chair Lincheski, I think you're going to find for different purposes states are going to use different measurements. As you know, the CPI, the implicit price deflator, I think is the one that you were looking for, are a measure of the growth in the economy, and they measure different things. The CPI is generally typically considered to be a good measurement of what's happening out in the lunch bucket economy, if you will. People are out there buying a collection of goods. An implicit price deflator, if I remember my history on this, was designed to measure a more specific piece of the economy. There is a measurement of the implicit price deflator that's supposed to be state and local government. Right. I've done some work on that, but there are critiques on either side. I think no matter which one you use, there's going to be a debate. For example, I can tell you in the school formulas for the growth in the operating referendum cap, we use the CPI. Is that the right measurement? I don't know, but it's the one that the policymakers back in 2003 decided to add. Those are my thoughts on that.
And Mr. Chair, excuse me, Representative Lincheski, I'd just add too, these are national figures. One could make an argument it should be more localized to Minnesota as well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. So, let's see. Where are we? All right. Ms. Brower, welcome to the committee. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. I've been asked to talk to you this morning about the demographic changes that we'll see in the coming years and their likely impacts on the state budget. Dr. Gillespie, my predecessor, did a fabulous job of letting everyone know about what was to come with our demographic changes into the future. And so I expect that many of the trends that I'll be presenting today, you will be familiar with. There are some big changes ahead for us in the state. And today I'll be describing what those changes are. Population aging in particular will present new challenges to our public expenditures, to the growth of our labor force, and it has the potential to impact economic growth going forward. The trend in increasing diversity as well is an important trend as it relates to the state budget. We project that the labor force will continue to become more diverse going forward, and that expectation, coupled with what we know about differences in educational outcomes for our students of color across racial groups, is concerning. Minnesota is historically well positioned to do well in the economy that favors high-skilled workers. We have the second highest concentration of education-intensive jobs here in the state relative to other places around the U.S., and we've begun to recover from the recession faster than many other places around the country, a fact that Dr. Hein owes points to our slightly higher concentration of these education-intensive jobs. At your request, Mr. Chair, I will also present information about how water resources may impact economic growth and demographic changes in the future, in the longer run. So I'll begin with population aging because that change is the most immediate. Population aging is unlike any kind of demographic shift that we've seen in our past, in our history. There are many other places that are experiencing this. Some are ahead of us on the curve, some are behind us. But Minnesotans have no experience with the transformation that we're about to undergo. So we're looking here at the number of additional older adults that were added during each decade to Minnesota, and it's always been between about 50,000 to 90,000 each decade. So that's additional older adults age 65 plus. This decade we'll be adding closer to 300,000 older adults to our population. The same will be true of the next decade. So this is, yes, I see big eyes. Yes, I agree. This is a big change for us going forward. And it's compressed into a very short period of time. Just over the next 17 years, we'll anticipate this change. The reason why this is happening so quickly is that the baby boomers who were born between 1946 and 64 are a very large cohort that's just poised to move above that 65-year-old age mark. So I'm showing you right now a graph with age groups. This is what Minnesota looks like by age. If you think about it as an escalator where every 5 years everyone moves up a bar, again in 5 years everyone moves up a bar, you start to get a sense of why this is happening now and why it's going to be a relatively short-term compressed thing. When we project what ages will be going forward, it's a relatively simple, straightforward projection. We know who's here now, and we know how old they will be in 5 and 10 and 15 years. And so this age wave will happen despite whatever we do day-to-day in our job. This is something that is inevitable. So if we think about this aging trend in terms of our two-year budget cycles, we're just at the beginning of that inflection point. This graph shows the total population, the growth in the total older adult population, and it's overlaid on two-year representing the future biennia. So it just gives you a sense that over the next 8 to 10 budget cycles, we're going to feel this increasing pressure of the older adult population. So we've looked at how the trend in aging will present itself to us here in Minnesota. Let's turn to anticipate the budget impacts of aging. You're all familiar with this pie probably, but I want to point your attention to the areas of the general fund budget that are specific to certain age groups here in Minnesota. So the K-12 spending is 42% of the general fund, and that serves our residents who are ages 5 to 17. A sizable portion of the health and human services budget is currently spent on older adults 65 and older. The primary areas of spending are elderly medical assistance, long-term care waivers, and long-term care facilities.
What was the number on older, the percentage of that on older?
Of older adults? So it's...
Could you say that? Maybe I missed.
No, no. About 16% of the whole budget is spent on elderly and disabled medical assistance. Yes, that's
okay.
Right.
So
the big questions going forward are how will healthcare costs change over the course of the next two decades and what will happen with enrollments? And how will that restrict spending in other areas? To my knowledge, the most recent and the only study of long-term budget trends in Minnesota comes from the Budget Trends Study Commission in 2008. That commission looked at healthcare spending and projected that if it were to continue to grow at the rate that it had been, at 8.5%, along with revenues that increased by about 4% each year, they carried that out over the 25-year period ahead of them and found that education and all other spending could only grow 0.2% in order to make a balanced budget. So this was done in 2008. Since the Budget Trend Study Commission reported on its work, we've gotten a better idea of what the long-term impact of the recession has meant for state revenues. If the commission were to set up a scenario today, I think their assumed revenue growth may be lower, making the situation more serious. And to create its scenario, the commission assumed a constant rate of growth in healthcare costs, which was really modeling inflation costs. They didn't do anything with increased enrollments, as we saw with the age trends. There's another portion of that growth that needs to be accounted for. On the other hand, with the changes underway in healthcare, it's difficult for me to say whether the same rate of growth would be assumed today. I'm not a program expert, but I want to remind you of what the Budget Trend Study Commission reported and give you some caveats for what we know since that time.
So just to clarify on the healthcare, 8.5% is just what they're projecting for general healthcare inflation and not accounting for the per capita increases that we're going to see.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Ms. Chair? Can we just go back? I mean, I'm guessing that's a powerful slide from the standpoint of what it says. So what it does say that projectedly health care costs go up about 4% and 8.5%, revenues going up 4%. And I don't know, is this per year? And if that's the case, then if we're on this track, that everything else that we budget within state government incrementally is able to go up only, you know, you suggest 0.2%. And even if healthcare costs become 6% and so on and so forth, that that number probably doesn't increase a lot in terms of the other revenue, the other expenditures, I'm sorry. Am I just tracking on that? Because I think that's a...
Ms. Barr.
Mr. Chair.
That slide says a lot.
Senator, yes, I agree. It does say a lot. That's how I interpret it as well, yes.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
According to our most recent projections, the older adult population will surpass the school age population by 2020 in a short period of time, just 8 years. And this is the first time that that will happen in our state's history. We can anticipate that spending pressures within the general fund will shift due to increased enrollments in the areas of health and human services. So I'd like to point out here that while we've heard a lot about this increasing older adult population, the student population will also be increasing, although at a much more moderate pace, as will the 18 to 24-year-old population, those who are typically in higher ed.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
So over the next 5 to 10 years, our older adult...
Representative Carlson had a question.
Yeah. Just a very quick one. When you're dealing with the demographic change, older workers, younger workers, brings to mind the workforce needs, and we hear that older workers are going to be working longer. delay in retirement and so on. Is there a chart here that builds any of that in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do make labor force projections. I can skip ahead since we're a little bit short on time here. We anticipate going forward that the labor force will slow, and that is including what we know of recent changes in labor force participation rates among the older adult population. So despite the fact that we know people are working a bit longer, the size of the baby boom cohort is so large that it doesn't make up for the growth, even those small increases in labor force participation.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, and Ms. Bauer. I think I heard at a previous presentation, and your slide, I think, is confirming it, but we've got this workforce retirement going on of our highly educated workforce. Do we have enough students graduating from high school and going on to higher ed to fill the retirements?
Ms. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Right now, that doesn't appear to be an issue. We are concerned over the longer term, what it will mean for our highly skilled jobs in terms of how far our young people are reaching in terms of educational attainment. At this point, it's not an issue of enough bodies, but it's enough. It's an issue of enough skilled, highly trained, highly educated people.
So do you want to go back or just go to your conclusions, whichever would you prefer? Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you. We anticipate that the pressure that will be exerted by the older adult population, that growth, that we won't be making it up necessarily because the younger populations will decline or remain the same. They'll be growing as well. On the spending side of the equation, other than what I shared from you from the Budget Trend Study Commission, we don't have specific projections over the long term. But we do have data that shows how demand changes for the services that are provided in part by public budgets. And I'll briefly review these in the next couple of slides. Here you see that medical expenses rise considerably with age. This graph is showing health care expenditures from all payment sources, but the average person has health care expenses at about $4,800 a year, and you can see for those 65 and older, it's closer to about $10,000 a year.
So this is private and public. This is everything. Okay.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
I think probably at some point we probably need a special session just to look at the implications, because this is actually a 20-year bubble, basically, and I can already see that some communities, I think, are overbuilding to deal with that, and then we're going to have to deal with when it busts, when this two-decades-long group moves through. But the other thing is that the assumptions are, I think, not really need to get more along the age continuum, because most of healthcare expenditures are like in the last 6 months to a year of life, and that's usually past age 75 or 80. And so sometimes when we use 65 as a cutoff, we're really way ahead of when some of those costs are really going to hit our state budget. And it'd be nice to have the Human Services Department and the demographer work on sort of helping us understand that long-term trend line.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lockler, I completely agree, yes. You can see for long-term care, I do have it broken out by smaller age groups. There is a tremendous growth over that period after age 65. So that in the earlier years, only 12% of older adults require long-term care, but you can see just how rapidly that grows to 75%. So when we're talking about baby boomers moving up over that 65-year-old age mark, they are relatively, they're young, they're healthy, they don't have those expenses, but yes, it will be compressed at some point over the next two decades.
So members, what I'd like to do is just maybe get to the implications of aging slide, and then we'll have to come back at another. I mean, you can
take the time to get there, but then we'll come back for the rest of it at another meeting.
So you can see there's going to be a great need for long-term care going forward. The Department of Human Services recently surveyed Minnesota baby boomers and asked them, how are you planning to pay for your long-term care? Over 30% said they didn't know how they would do that. A large percentage, just over 15%, said that they had long-term care insurance. And again, a fairly large proportion, 15 to 20%, said that they would rely on a government program for their long-term care. So if you add some of those categories, the don't know, the government program, for example, that's potentially a substantial proportion, 50% or more, of baby boomers who either don't have a plan or will be anticipating government services for their long-term care. We talked about the labor force growth slowing. This is, again, because the baby boomers are exiting the labor force at a rate that's faster than that younger generation moving in. We anticipate that our labor force will continue to grow, but much more slowly than what we've come to understand is normal. This is important because the growth of our labor force is closely tied to our economic output. In the past, we could rely on a seamless endless supply of workers to kind of propel our economy forward, to propel the goods and services that we are producing here in Minnesota. But going forward, we're not going to have that endless supply. It will be slowed. And so we'll have to rely much more on productivity gains going forward, which implies higher skilled workers. I trust most of you have seen the Tom and Tom show. They increase this fact. They stress this fact for many years. We've heard this, that it's going to be the gains in productivity that are going to give us a competitive advantage.
And so is this labor force growth, is that, what does that take into account? Does it take into account both immigration and natural growth, I guess?
Mr. Speaker, yes. We look at what the population is likely to do based on immigration, births, and deaths going forward. So we get a population base and make those projections. And then we apply what we think labor force participation rates will be, taking into account extended labor force participation at the older ages. Yes. Thank you. So to recap, the implications of aging. Age will bring rising health care costs and long-term care needs. Anticipated enrollments and spending pressures in public budgets will likely be concentrated in medical assistance, in basic care, in the elderly waiver, and nursing care facilities. I didn't talk about the income tax collections, but that's another. There's an age pattern to income tax collections that is certainly that's something that could have an effect on the revenue side. And then the slower labor force growth could mean slower growth in GDP going forward, depending on what happens with our productivity.
So any other questions on those items? Or I think we'll come back at the next meeting and start with the I guess, growing diversity issues and move from there. But thank you.
Thank you.
For your help. Anything else, members? All right, we are adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, I forgot to bring it up, but I'm also in